Well, thank you, Rodrigo and Veronica, and yeah, thank you everybody for, as you mentioned earlier, for coming early in the morning, but at least it's not as early as the ARS meeting the other day, which was at 6 in the morning. But anyway, as she said, I'm located in Weslaco, where you see that little red star there. And my projects are, currently I'm working on a Rundo Donax giant reed, and we're just beginning a project on guinea grass, Panica maximum. But prior to that, I was located overseas at the USDA laboratory in Brisbane, Australia. So I was doing exploration for Ligodium and Melaleuca, you know, weeds that are plants that are native to that region and invasive in Florida. So native range studies are, you know, really dear to me, and I think that they've provided me a lot of insight, and I think that they're really important in biocontrol. So I'm going to give you examples from my previous work in Australia and my current projects in Texas. So these are the topics that I'd like to discuss. You know, how do you include native range studies in your exploration? You know, climate, molecular methods. I'm going to try to talk about the details in climate and molecular that don't preempt the talks later in the program on this. And also, you know, doing the impact studies and field host range, you know, in your native range studies, you know, how do you incorporate all that? Because this whole package, I think, is really important for the regulators. You know, they're trying to make decisions on safety and efficacy, and this is the type of information that they're looking for in our, you know, tag petitions or, you know, our petitions for release of biocontrol agents in North America. So if you talk about foreign exploration here, you know, I think from my experience, you know, and talking to other people that have done this for, you know, more years than I have, you know, it's really, you know, important to get out there and see the entire native range and to keep getting out to all these parts of the native range to look, because there are effects of seasonality on the insects, and some insects or mites will be geographically isolated in just certain parts of the native range. And some of them can be rare at certain times of the year. So if you don't repeatedly get out and search all these areas, you know, doing these native range studies, you can really miss good agents. And I think I've got an example here to show you of that. But time in the field, you know, budgeting this into a biocontrol program, I think, is very important if you're going to have safe and effective agents. So the example comes from Ligodium. Here's a picture of it in Florida, you know, spreading across the tree islands. We did the surveys in the native range of which goes all the way from Australia right up into Southeast Asia, and of the 500 collections during that five-year time period, you know, we went back and analyzed the data to determine, you know, what did we find in the collections. Two things were pretty common, you know, the mite, which is the black bar there, and the pyralid moths. You know, both of those, the pyralid moths and the mite have both made it through the tag process. You know, those would have probably been fairly easy to find if you were just doing adventive surveys, you know, short periods of time. But the other agents that you see trickling out across that bar graph, you know, they are very uncommon in the field. Maybe they're geographically isolated or only occur at certain times of the year. And if you look at this bar right here, you know, this is a stem boring pyralid, very unusual biology. And it's one of the agents that the researchers in Fort Lauderdale are really interested in. So we found it during that time period, but it was really uncommon. And it's taken directed efforts later on in the program to find more of them so that the program could proceed with host range testing. So my take home message from this is you really need a lot of time in the field. So how does climate fit in there? Well, you know, I'm working on a Rundo now, and this is a climax map, which defines pretty much the native range of a Rundo in the Mediterranean. And, you know, this is, if you're familiar with climax, you can have it with natural rainfall, or you can add rainfall to it. And if you add rainfall to it, you get a little bit different map here. And if you can see that the climax tells you that the temperatures and humidity really across North Africa, the Arabian Peninsula, are very suitable for a Rundo, but you need to have that supplemental water. Well, in this case, the supplemental comes from rare oases that occur out in the Sahara Desert. And two of these oases, you know, here with the purple triangles, you know, we hypothesize that, hey, if the climate is suitable, And there's supplemental water from these springs that the plant would occur there. No records at all of the plant there, but indeed the explorer went down to that area and found it. And I think it's going to be the source of some really neat native range studies in these springs up in the Hogar Mountains. And these agents could be better adapted to South Texas and Mexico, where the Arundo grows at much more southerly latitudes. So the scale, just quickly here, this is the predicted native range of the scale using Climax. And if you can, it's a smaller subset of the native range than the plant itself. So we know that the insect seems to be limited by maybe cold temperatures in the winter. But the actual distribution is really even a smaller subset of that. And I think this has spurred us to do a native range studies in Spain to try and determine really what is limiting this insect. And I don't have the answer yet. We're just beginning on that with cooperators there and near Valencia. But I think that it's going to be important to us because it may help us find the right agent for Texas and Mexico. Well, molecular, and I really, there's going to be a great talk later by John Gaskin on molecular, and certainly his ideas on molecular have influenced a lot of my own and been important in my research, but I just wanted to give you a part of how the native range fit into this into these molecular methods. Well, here's where we went during the exploration of Ligodium for these, 6 years, and we found a number of different herbivores. And one of the ones that we concentrated on was the aerified mite. And what we found, I'm going to go forward here, we found that the plant had multiple genotypes throughout the native range. And it took us a long time to find this genotype number 6, which matched up with Florida. So we were finding Ligodium all through this area, but we could not find a mite that would actually feed and develop well on the Florida genotype of the plant. So we genotyped the insects, and what we found was a nice correlation between everywhere you found a new genotype of the fern, you found a new genotype of the mite. And what we did was we took tiny sporling ferns in plastic boxes, and we went to all these locations throughout the native range and collected the mite locally and tested it on the Florida genotype of the fern. And I think this, just within, an 8-month period, we're able to get out there, I think, pretty easily and test the local genotypes in what I would call native range studies. So it was pretty easy to take the plant to the mites and get this information as to whether or not they would feed and develop on it. They would not. So that really spurred us, I think, in our native range studies to keep looking and try to find that genotype F there, which matched Florida. And from talking to the group researchers in Florida, there's probably even still more to this genotype mite genotype interaction. So how about the impact studies? These can tell you just what you might expect in terms of plant damage, to your target. And for Ligodium, we were concerned with the mite, how big of an impact it might have. Because many mites had been used in biocontrol of weeds, but none of them had really been spectacular. So we set up this randomized block design here, and we sprayed half of the plants with the miticide and watched the plants grow, recorded plant growth traits over a 2-year period. And what we found was greater than 50% reduction in plant growth where we had the mite as compared to where we sprayed it. And we also found that the Florida genotype of the plant did not, the local Queensland genotype of the mite did not feed on the Florida genotype of the fern. So all this kind of spurred us to learn more about the genetics of the plant and the mite. And incidentally, when we found that the local Queensland genotype of the mite did not feed on this Florida invasive genotype, we killed the Florida plants in the field there because, there was the potential for them to become weedy. Even though they occurred much further north in Australia, we didn't want to get a local population going. So what about field host range? This can be a very important part of native range studies. And an example comes from Arundo. Here you see Arundo invasive in Big Bend National Park, channeling, changing the channel morphology of the river and shading the river, really doing quite a bit of damage. And one of the key agents that we're working with is a diaspid scale. And those little yellow dots you see there are the crawler scale. And what we do is we take the producing mother scale off the plant, put them in these gelatin capsules, and as the crawler scale emerges from the females, we can move them over in set numbers to the test plants to do our no-choice tests. So what we found was that the Arundo, you know, was highly specific, the scale was highly specific to Arundo, as we knew from Europe, but we had this minor development on these two native plants, Leptochloa. So we proposed that we would go and do native range studies in Spain to look at, to determine if this was a quarantine artifact or not. Well, we were really lucky in that both of these plants have become, even though they're native to North America, they've become invasive in the native range of Arundo. So we were able to find places in Spain and France where these plants occur sympatrically with Arundo and with the Arundo scale. So we were able to go there, collect the plants, and look at them under the microscope to see if they indeed had the scale on them, and then also opportunistically look at any other grass plant growing in that area. So these are the locations that we went to in Spain. The yellow dots are rice growing areas where this Leptochloa, this native grass from Texas, has become invasive. And by the way, they call it Texas grass there in Spain. And it was kind of odd to see a diminutive little native plant from Texas become so gigantic and invasive there in the rice growing areas. But here's what it looks like. You know, you can see in this picture here, this is rice growing near Valencia, and the Leptochloa grows commonly along the weed along the margins and grows right together with the Arundo. And these Arundo are just full of the scale, of the Arundo scale. And we could collect these plants, bring back huge bags to the hotel, dissect them. I mean, this is a real native range study right in the hotel room. So with Spartina, it was a little bit more interesting in that the Spartina here growing next to the Arundo, it had its own scale on it, which looked really similar to the Arundo scale, but it's indeed a different genus. And here you have the Arundo growing with the scale, with the Arundo scale right next to it. So this gives you the kind of evidence in a native range study of host range. So I guess our conclusion from that was that the field host range did not include these other non-target grasses, and that we, you know, believe that it should be recommended for release in North America. You know, there's other ways to do this. If you're not lucky enough for your non-targets to be invasive in the native range, well, you can plant things out. And certainly there are a lot of good examples from this. You know, the Melaleuca program set up a common garden experiment there in Brisbane, and they were able to see that one of the bugs that was an early candidate fed on guava. So I think that was really informative. I know Lincoln has done a lot of neat work with common garden experiments for yellow star thistle agents. And we're, you know, trying to look at all these common garden studies and design them for guinea grass, which is our next project. And the initial exploration in Africa tells us there's something going on that controls this weedy perennial grass, but it looks like it's happening below ground. So our plan is to go back in there and set up common garden experiments where we use classes of insecticides that could kill nematicides, maybe to kill nematodes, insecticides to kill insects, and just begin to do this, you know, coarse sort of organisms to tell us what might actually be an agent, because it's obviously not a really a well-known thing like a Lepidoptera or a weevil or anything feeding on this grass there in Africa. So it's going to take some work, I think, to intense native range studies to get to the answer. So finally, regulatory considerations. You know, the regulators, you know, when you talk to them, these type of native range studies are really important to them because they give them a good idea of the host range, of the impact. And these type of things, you know, they're found in the BC of Weeds, you know, Code of Ethics. And all this stuff is going to be incorporated in the new TAG Weed Manual. You know, the manual is being updated, I think after 10 years, and what they want to incorporate are more native range, pre-release impact studies, field host range. So I think the kind of things that we're doing in our research, you know, right now will be incorporated more formally into what TAG and NAPO are looking for. And NAPO is the North American organization, which is part of the FAO, and they also have their weed biocontrol guidelines. So these things are going to be discussed over the next year and probably incorporated into TAG. And incidentally, for insect biocontrol workers, you know, there's going to be a new TAG for insects. So there's a lot of new regulations in the works, and I think it's going to take a lot of discussion with researchers so that we ask researchers to do things that are possible and not so onerous that they can't be done. But I think that they are looking for more information of this type. And lastly, the access question. You know, this relates to native range studies, because if we can't get into certain countries to work because they're fearful that we're going to take unique genetic material and use it for profit, you know, it precludes you from doing this type of work. And this issue is going to be taken on in a big way by NAPO. Peter Mason, who's on NAPO, I'm also on the NAPO committee. You know, we want to kick this up to a higher level, you know, for discussion, because, you know, certainly there are areas that are very difficult to get into now, but yet we're going to have to work there at some point in the future. So with that, thank you, and appreciate your attention this morning, and look forward to the other talks. Thank you.
We have plenty of time for questions.
Jim?
John, you talked about bringing plants like from Florida to, I guess, it's Australia, Lycodium.
Mm-hmm.
I agree, the native range tests are obviously important, but is there an issue with maybe the Australian government having green plants from other countries into their country? You have to get permits to do this? How does that all work?
Yeah, it all works through permits, and, you know, there's very, tight safeguards to prevent reproduction locally, but you know, they realize the importance of it, and I guess they trust the researchers, you know, to do this. In some cases you can't, like Florida wax myrtle. I mean, that would be a difficult one to import because it doesn't occur there.
Like we experienced a lot of resistance in Brazil to bring stuff down there. They used to allow stuff to go in, but
yeah,
they didn't bring anything down.
It's certainly needed, but it's a tricky issue, and I think it takes a lot. It takes the trust with the regulatory bodies. Julie?
Well, I was just wondering, is the flow of biocontrol agents one way into the U.S.? Do we not work enough cooperatively with other countries? Because if you looked globally, if they were benefiting as much as we were and understood that it's reciprocal, maybe this wouldn't be an issue.
That's a good point, and maybe that's what, you know, IOBC is involved in this, and I think that it is reciprocal, but I think the vectors are towards, you know, probably the U.S., Australia, South Africa, and a lot of these other parts of the world maybe have not been recipients, but they could be. I know we've shared agents with China readily, and, you know, you look
maybe
at
that's a positive way to look
yeah,
at it.
You look at water hyacinth agents, you know, they've been easily shared around the world, Salvinia. Sanford?
Yes, just a comment. I know that Brazil has a very active biocontrol program, and they do get a number of agents from the United States to help with their issues as well.
Good. Well, I know Greg Wheeler has mentioned that he has got good cooperation out of Brazil, so it can be done, and maybe there's...
I'm talking about the U.S. to Brazil.
U.S. to Brazil. Can you give us an example of an agent that we've sent down there?
I cannot do that, but if you talk to Marjorie Hoy, I believe that these were for citrus.
Okay, right. I guess the point is that we need to make a better case that we are sharing worldwide, and that we're different from, say, a plant, plant product prospectors that are looking for the next new miracle drug. And okay, thank you.